Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, March 11, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, we'll be discussing originalism and the new book by Professors John McGinnis and Michael Rappaport. I am Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and as always, we're recording today's call for use as a podcast in the future. We're pleased to welcome not just our two authors, but a third expert to the call today. We're going to be hearing opening remarks from each of them in turn, and then probably some back and forth as they respond to each other. But then ultimately, as always, we'll be getting to your questions, so please try to be thinking of questions as we go through the presentations. We're going to have opening remarks of about 6 to 8, maybe 10 minutes from each of them, and then your questions. We'll start with Professor John O. McGinnis. He is the George C. Dix Professor in Constitutional Law at Northwestern University School of Law. He'll be followed by Professor Michael B. Rappaport. He is the Darling Foundation Professor of Law at the University of San Diego Law School. And then we'll get comments from Professor Michael S. Griva. He's at the George Mason University School of Law. And with that, Professor McGinnis, please get us started with your opening remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Dean, and thanks very much to the Federalist Society for having us here to speak about our new book, Originalism and the Good Constitution. Mike Rappaport's in my new book. In this book, we offer a defense of originalism on somewhat new grounds on the argument that interpreting the Constitution according to its original meaning, that meaning that was fixed at the time of the Constitution and its amendments, is a better, likely to be better than the alternatives, and specifically living constitutionalism. I'm going to make three points here. One, describe why we think creating the Constitution through supermajority rules is a good way of creating the Constitution, and that our Constitution comes from that. Then I'm going to contrast that with the living Constitution, and finally talk about another advantage of our argument for originalism. It underscores how important originalism is in promoting the process of constitutional amendment. Well, let's begin very briefly with the argument that originalism is good because it's the best way of preserving the way of creating a good constitution. The way of creating a good constitution, in our view, is through pretty stringent supermajority rules. I'll be very brief here about why that's the case. Stringent supermajority rules create a consensus behind the constitution. A consensus is very important in creating the allegiance and affection for a constitution that's necessary for our fundamental law. The alternative, majoritarianism, would actually create a more partisan and divisive constitution. Another advantage is that it's hard to create entrenched provisions, provisions that are going to endure long into the future without very substantial deliberation. And a supermajority rule, by restricting the kinds of things that can be considered, creates a more intense form of deliberation. And finally, and this is well known in the political science literature, a supermajoritarian rule creates a kind of veil of ignorance because it's hard to get rid of a rule that's done that has to be repealed through supermajority rules. People are more likely to consult the public interest rather than their own parochial interest. And therefore, we're going to get a good distribution of powers. People are not going to figure out how to distribute the powers to the president based on who they think the president's going to be. That's one kind of advantage. Another advantage is it might actually help generate minority rights. People aren't sure of where they're going to be, where their children are going to be, and so they're more likely to grant rights in the public interest rather than on the basis of where they happen to be at the time the Constitution is created. So that's the argument for that. It doesn't mean that we're going to create a perfect Constitution, but it's just likely to be good, and there's no better way of doing it. Our next argument is that the Constitution, our Constitution, is created through pretty stringent supermajority rules. That's very clear in the amendment process. Two-thirds of the House and the Senate have to propose, and three-quarters of the states have to enact. It's a little less clear in the original Constitution, but we still think that also qualifies. Article 7 requires 9 of the 13 states to ratify the Constitution, And that provision happened with in the middle of really the process for creating the Constitution. There had to be effectively a pretty strong supermajority at the Philadelphia Convention if the Constitution was going to get going. And we think that the Constitution, that supermajoritarian aspect, is responsible for some of the great parts of the Constitution. The Nationalists had to compromise with those interested more in states, autonomy for states. And the Bill of Rights was actually a condition which was required by some of the people, some of the states, at the end of the ratification process. We may not have gotten the Bill of Rights without the supermajority rule. It really creates the big bang of our constitutional universe that's responsible for so many of the key features that are admired around the world. Well, let's contrast that with living constitutionalism. I mean, first of all, let me just say that if I think follows from that, we should interpret the Constitution according to its original meaning, because it's that meaning that got this consensus that we think is beneficial. And the contrast with living constitutionalism is, I think, becomes palpable. In living constitutionalism, in one way or another, the Supreme Court updates the Constitution, creates new kinds of constitutional rights, or subtracts constitutional rights according to its preferences and its understanding of what the nation needs. And the Supreme Court is hardly supermajoritarian. It's 9 justices who live in the most artificial city in the world. That's quite the opposite of a continental consensus. And it's worse than that. It's 9 justices who are elite lawyers, a very a small kind of group of society. And it's in today, it's even worse than that. All the lawyers come from 2 law schools, Harvard and Yale Law School, which underscores the kind of elite perspective. And as for geographic diversity, well, I've heard it said that at least the Supreme Court represents 4 of the 5 boroughs of New York City. I think that underscores how problematic it is for having the court create the Constitution. And remember that it even can change the constitutional law in living constitutionalism by a majority vote. It's not even a supermajority on the Supreme Court. So I think we show, I hope, why a good constitution is created by a supermajoritarian process, and that originalism captures that process in quite strong distinction from the alternative of living constitutionalism. Well, let me just say the final point is that we also, I think, underscore how important originalism is to protecting the amendment process, because there is a different way of updating the Constitution in the Constitution itself other than living constitutionalism. The people themselves can pass constitutional amendments. But non-originalism really strikes at the heart of the constitutional amendment process. There were very important amendments passed, the 17th, the 16th Amendment, the income tax, the direct election of senators, the right of women to vote. But as non-originalism took hold, we've had less dramatic amendments. And I think there's a reason for that, Mike and I. It's that if the Supreme Court is anticipating the constitutional amendments, they're going to take the oxygen from the constitutional amendment process. They're going to decide where the next amendment is going to be. And secondly, of course, it becomes much more incentivizing the groups not to change the Constitution by the amendment process, but to change it by the membership of the Supreme Court. And then people trust the Supreme Court less. And that's another reason the amendment process is going to be used less. And all of those things were apparent in the ERA. People were worried about what the Supreme Court would do with it. The Supreme Court had already anticipated much of the Equal Rights Amendment. So our last argument that at least I'd like to leave you with is that the amendment process and originalism are inextricably intertwined. There can't be a good constitution without an amendment process to update it, but there can't be an effective amendment process without originalism. The amendment process and originalism walk under the same banner. And what does that banner say? It says that we the people here do constitutional politics, not we the elite judges. And that's just not because we're populist, but because the process by which we the people create the Constitution is likely to be a lot better than the process by which just a few people update or create the Constitution. So thank you very much, and I'll turn that over to my co-author, Mike Rappaport.
Thanks, John. Well, in addition to the normative and supermajority arguments that John discussed, the book also deals with two issues that are of central importance for originalism: how one should determine the original meaning, and the role of precedent within originalism. So let me discuss each of these. First, originalists have been arguing about the right way of determining the original meaning for a couple of decades now. One view is that the interpreters should look to the original intent of the framers of the Constitution. Another view is that interpreters should look to the original public meaning of the Constitution, as understood by a reasonable speaker with knowledge of the language. In the book, we defend a third approach to determining the original meaning of the Constitution, what we call original methods originalism. Under original methods, one interprets the Constitution by using the interpretive method that would have been deemed applicable to the Constitution at the time of its enactment. Thus, we do not figure out what we regard as the best interpretive approach. Instead, we apply the interpretive rules that people at the time would have employed. Now, there are two basic arguments for original methods originalism. The first is a non-normative interpretive argument, and the second argument is a normative argument. So let me start with the interpretive argument. The basic idea underlying original methods originalism is that to determine the original meaning of the Constitution, one should apply the same interpretive rules that the framers' generation would have applied. If we were to apply different interpretive rules, then we would get a different meaning than the framers would have found in the document. That meaning would not be the original meaning, so we want to apply the original interpretive rules. Now consider the normative argument. As John has indicated, we argue that the original Constitution is likely to be desirable because it was enacted through a supermajoritarian process. But to get to the desirable content, the content that was enacted through that supermajoritarian process, we need to look to the meaning that the framers' generation would have employed, not the meaning supplied by William Brennan or Richard Posner or any other modern person. Thus, one needs to apply the original meaning and to determine it by applying the original interpretive rules in order to get the desirable normative content, the desirable content from the supermajoritarian process. Original methods originalism also supplies, we think, an alternative to the constructionist approach of some new originalists. These new originalists argue that when the Constitution is vague or ambiguous, the original meaning runs out. In these situations, which they often term decisions in the construction zone, the interpreter must apply some extra constitutional content, because after all, the original meaning is run out, which could be, depending on the theorist, based on one's political theory, early practice, modern values. It all depends on the theorist. We are skeptical of such constructionist decisions. And we believe that the original interpretive rules will often provide an answer regarding vague or ambiguous provisions. So if you can resolve them with the original interpretive rules, you don't need construction. To give one example, the original interpretive rules often require the interpreter, in close cases, to select the stronger interpretation between two contending meanings. In these situations, the original meaning will not run out. Instead, there'll be two reasonable interpretations, but one will often be superior. Now let me move on to the second basic issue, precedent. Some originalists believe that following precedent is inconsistent with the original meaning of the Constitution. Now, if that were true, then originalism would be open to a strong objection, since overturning some possible non-originalist precedents, such as the constitutionality of Social Security or paper money, could have enormous bad consequences. But we think that the original meaning of the Constitution allows precedent. Precedent was an important part of the law at the time of the Constitution, and many discussions of the Constitution assumed that precedent would apply. No one, to our knowledge, actually argued that the Constitution would abrogate precedent. We believe that the Constitution treated precedent as a matter of common law. Thus, common law rules govern precedent, and that common law could be revised by congressional statute. That precedent is a matter of common law that can be revised by congressional statute raises the question what the optimal precedent doctrine would look like. In the book, we begin the discussion of this important issue by arguing for an intermediate approach to precedent, one that often applies the original meaning, but applies non-originalist precedent when strong reasons support it. Now, in the absence of such strong reasons, we would apply the original meaning of the Constitution based on the theory that the supermajoritarian enactment of the original meaning of the Constitution is likely to be desirable, kind of things that John talked about. An optimal precedent doctrine should apply rules rather than vague standards as much as possible. And in the book, we discuss two precedent rules that we believe justify following non-originalist precedents. I'll go into them briefly here. One rule would require following non-originalist precedent when overturning it would result in enormous costs. Now, defining enormous costs is difficult, but we offer some suggestions in the book. For example, we argue that one should classify a decision as one that creates enormous costs only if it would require immediate action by the legislature. The second precedent rule would require following non-originalist precedent when it has so much support that its support is comparable to what would be required to pass a constitutional amendment. We call such precedents entrenched precedents. So under this approach, precedents such as Griswold versus Connecticut would be treated as entrenched precedents and followed, since virtually everyone supports that, whereas precedents such as Roe v. Wade would not be. Well, there's quite a bit more in the book, but I think it's best to stop here and to allow Michael Greva to tell us what's not in the book or what shouldn't have been in the book, and then we'll have questions later on.
Okay, this is Mike Greva. Thanks, John and Mike, and thanks to the Federalist Society. Look, I should make it clear at the front end for our listeners, this is really a disagreement to the extent that there is any among friends. I have no truck with the living constitution either. I sort of like the democratic impulse behind this that John talked about. I completely agree with John. It's high time for justice from Staten Island. Most of what I have to say is sort of by way of preparation for questions. And a second caveat I should state at the front end, that there are sort of two issues that I wanted to address because that's sort of most of the book. One is the supermajority and constitution-making aspect. And the other is the original methods, originalism. I have to confess, I know a little bit about constitutions and constitution making. I know very, very little about the originalism debate. I have a few questions about it, but if our listeners want to pursue this in greater depth and nuance, that's really up to them and not me. So let me start at the front end with the supermajority. And the key argument here that won the adoption of the Constitution was supermajoritarian, and that strict supermajority rules tend to produce a good Constitution. I have a few quibbles with that, but that's neither here nor there. And on the whole, I think this is quite plausible, and it's a very helpful discussion. So my question, as Mike Rappaport just surmised, is not about what the book says, but what it leaves out. And here's what I mean. The authors say at some point, at one point, wisely to my judgment, that the supermajoritarian requirements are neither necessary nor sufficient for a good constitution. And it's easy to see why that is so, why it's not necessary. So think of Germany and Japan. Those are, by any measure, realistic measure, I think, good constitutions. But they're occupation constitutions, and mercifully, nobody thought of asking the Germans or the Japanese at that time, let alone a supermajority of them, what they actually wanted. Here's the sufficient part. The question, if you take this up one level, the question is what procedure or process gives you confidence in the result, or what is likely to produce good results? And there's a vast literature on that, especially since the 1990s, as more sort of countries in the former Soviet Union and Soviet bloc wrote constitutions, and political scientists went over that. But the literature I have in mind is a little closer to home, and it's the Federalist. If you think back to the founding, the Federalist had every reason to think about what's necessary, what are the necessary and sufficient conditions of a good constitution. And they had every reason to argue that, look, to persuade their audience and their listeners that, look, you can trust this document, this construct, because the process was good and legitimate. And lo and behold, so they did argue, and you'll see that if you read Federalist 1 and 2 and 37 and 40, and that's the sort of gist of the argument. And I think what they say there casts, to my mind, at least some doubt on John's and Michael's account. So I just go through four of the things that the Federalist mentions. It's not all that they discuss, but those are the elements that I think speak to the supermajority piece of the puzzle here. The first thing that they say is, look, for constitution making, what makes this possible is the crisis. It's a constitutional moment, in Bruce Ackerman's word. And the reason why that is important for the process is that without it, without some palpable crisis, you cannot talk people out of their narrow short-term preferences at all, no matter what the majority requirements are. The second thing that they mention is we are one people to all practical intents and purposes. As one people, we have fought a war. That's in Federalist 2. Why is that so important with respect to the supermajority requirement? Here's why I think it's important. You can imagine a situation where there are 40% Sunni Muslims, 30% Shia Muslims, and 30% Kurds. Under those conditions, supermajoritarianism just translates into oppressing the Kurds brutally and ruthlessly at the front end. And supermajoritarian requirements won't do any of the things that John outlined. It won't be conducive to deliberation. It won't be productive of a veil of ignorance because these people know who they are. It won't be productive of consensus. I mean, consensus only in the sense that we have two-thirds majority for oppression. Let's go. So under those kinds of conditions, you'd need some very, very different mechanisms, it seems to me. And if that seems too far away, I think that there's a serious argument that had the Constitution or had the cotton gin been invented, 30 years earlier, people might have thought of themselves as sort of existential slaveholders or existential opponents of slavery, in which case no majority requirement, I think, would have done the job. Here's the third thing. The convention itself, Madison says, should give you confidence. And what he says is not that, the convention was supermajoritarian, because it wasn't. What he says is, first, the delegates were legitimate because they were sent by states, and second, they were respected patriots, and these people could set an agenda. And that's very important because without an agenda setter, any legislative process, regardless of majority requirements, will be completely irrational. Anything could happen. And so it was very important to have, you know, Madison and the Virginia Plan and Robert Morris to nominate George Washington as president and on and on and on. All of that was very important. This is why you can have confidence. It's not the voting procedure. And the final thing is, there's, as John mentioned, the approval by states, 9 out of 13 states. Madison does discuss that, and he discusses it for two reasons. One is that it was probably illegal under the Articles, but it doesn't matter, he says. And second, the approval, he says, is by the people themselves, conventions, as opposed to state legislatures. What he doesn't say is that, so why doesn't he make the same supermajoritarian argument that John and Mike make? And I think the answer is that it isn't supermajoritarian. Supermajoritarian would be, okay, there are 13 of us, and so long as 9 approve, we're all in. That is not what Article 7 says. What it says is no state can be made a member of the Union without its consent by convention. That's a unanimity requirement on one side, and on the other side, it's a simple majority requirement for each individual state. So where does that leave us, or where does that leave me? My question to John and Mike is simply, given that it's not necessary and sufficient, how much is it actually that you want to hang on the supermajority requirement in this regard with respect to legitimacy or goodness or whatever you want to call it? The one sentence that, I mean, I read all of this with great profit, and it was terrific. The one sentence, I suppose, that bothered me was that you'd say at some point, this is a new view of what made our founding great. And my question is, would it be offensive if I simply think of this as a useful, very useful addition to the old view, not sort of hero worship and ooh, ah, a miracle, but the Federalist view of the matter? So that's my first set of questions. The second piece is the original methods piece. And there I have sort of two questions. First, how much of constitutional law or practice do you think is covered by interpretation? And the second question is, what do we actually know about constitutional canons at the time? And let me explain. So at one point you say, and this is on page 144, the Constitution contains no provision delegating the power to fill gaps in the Constitution. Here's my simple question. What do you do with a grant of maritime jurisdiction? That's not just a gap-filling thing. I mean, gaps in the Constitution or statutes. It's the authority to import and develop an entire body of law, and they cannot have believed that that would be stable over time. And mind you, I mean, how far that jurisdiction reaches and how it hangs together with the Commerce Clause and federalism and all the rest of it, plainly constitutional. So how does one get to that by way of originalist interpretation, excuse me, methods or otherwise? And the second question is simply John Marshall's famous sentence, right? We must never forget it's a constitution we're expounding. When the Supreme Court quotes that, you can be sure that the rest of it is purely invented, but that's not what I have in mind. Here's what I think he means. He means, first, what he means is that the nature of the instrument dictates how you read it. So the Constitution isn't a statute, and it isn't a contract. So how does it differ? You know, two parts to the answer, at least, or let me cover two parts of the answer. One is he insists that you can't understand any clause unless you understand all of the instrument, and you can't understand that without understanding the nature of the union, as he sometimes says, or, as he says in other parts, the genius of representative government, which could be ours, but not necessarily ours. And the second thing is, what's unique to a constitution, not totally unique, but distinctive about it in lots of ways, is you cannot make the document work without additional doctrines or rules. So, second part of McCulloch is, states cannot tax federal instruments. Actually, it's a whole lot more complicated and involved than that, but that's the basic rule. You need some rule in that domain, it seems to me, because the answer, once the question is before you, you have to say yes or no. And the way he goes about it is, well, presumably the founders wanted this instrument to work. And so if I have a close question like that, I'll pick the rule that makes the document work as well as it will. But, I mean, if you don't agree with that, and it's, again, a genuine question, what text do you go to interpret and to get to a rule on that question and similar questions? And we can all think of lots of questions like that. I mean, does original meaning or original methods, originalism, tell you whether he got it right or wrong in that case and other cases like that? So that's my final question. In other words, was John Marshall an originalist? And if not, what follows? And that's about it.
Well, thank you, Michael Greva. Let's turn back to Professors Rapoport and McGinnis for responses. I think this can be somewhat unstructured. Why don't either one of you take any of the questions?
There's
about six or seven points here, and maybe we should just treat them all individually. John, you want to start off?
Yes, I'm just going to start off, and one of the things I'm going to do is be consciously brief, because I do want to allow time for questions from callers. Michael gives some very interesting comments, which could easily take up the rest of our time, but I'd like to allow some time for questions. So, I agreed with a lot of what Michael said, because, of course, we are quite clear that we aren't saying that it's either sufficient or necessary. But it is something that gives us confidence that it's a better way of making a constitution than the alternative of living constitutionalism. So I don't think any of the things, and there's only one part I think I do disagree with what Michael said, really undermine our basic point, which is to contrast, at least here, living constitutionalism with a way of creating a good constitution. Michael suggests that there are other, perhaps, conditions for that. They're all met. We have a people, maybe the crisis. We don't have a crisis all the time, but yet we think still a supermajoritarian, for the reasons we suggested, are likely to lead to better provisions, certainly in an amendment process, than the alternative. So I don't think they, while very interesting, I don't think they undermine our core position, which is that it's, of course, there may be a better constitution, or you might get a constitution in some other way, but this gives us confidence that we're likely have a good constitution, along with its fruits, some of the things that we've mentioned, like Bill of Rights and federalism, and that gives us a reason to follow originalism rather than a living constitution. The only thing I would say that I disagree with, I do think the original constitution is super majoritarian, despite the fact that a majority of people in the states ratified it. It still required 9 of the 13 states to come into existence at all. And so that, I think, is an important formal aspect of supermajoritarianism. And it's true that states that didn't want to come in wouldn't be bound, but you wouldn't have had a constitution at all unless the constitution represented a consensus or a substantial consensus of the one people that Michael correctly reminds us were around in the original constitution.
Okay, well, let me talk about the original methods part. Just before I do that, I just want to mention, so the enactment process and the amendment process are very similar, and we do see very significant amendments in the 19th century without crises, right? We see the 16th Amendment with the income tax and the direct election of senators and women's right to vote, and those don't actually have crises. So I actually think the amendment process shows that we can actually have, you know, concerns, you know, things that are important to the people, but still get a supermajority enactment of a new constitutional provision without a crisis. Obviously, it's to be expected that if you're actually going to replace the whole Constitution, you probably need some good reason for doing so. And so that would, I think, account for the fact that you often have crises. But anyway, let me move on to the original method portion of this. So Michael says a couple of points here. He says, how much of constitutional law today is a function of interpretation? And I guess the question is, versus what else? What else could it be? And I suppose it could be kind of made-up Supreme Court doctrine or construction or any number of different things. And I guess I would acknowledge that lots of constitutional law today is not interpretation. That is the problem. It's not a feature, it's a bug. Yes, it's true, but we think actually that much more of it, you know, pretty much everything except for what's protected by precedent should be interpretation. Michael asks about what I think is a pretty interesting question about the maritime jurisdiction. Isn't that a way in which the framers delegated power to the courts? And I think that's true, but true in a different way than what we have in mind. So the maritime jurisdiction is basically an acknowledgement of the power of the courts to have common law decision making with respect to maritime jurisdiction. So the first point to, and maybe the most important point here, is that this is not about delegating to the courts constitutional law. It's instead the traditional power of common law that can then be overturned in most cases by statute, right? So the very significant difference with respect to constitutional law, of course, is that it can't be overturned by statute. In general, the Constitution does a lot of delegating to both the courts and to the Congress and to the states with respect to kind of keeping the laws of the Republic up to date. What it doesn't do is say to the Supreme Court, oh, by the way, we also want you to adjust the meaning of the Constitution to keep it up to date. No, the Constitution rejects that. And then, so that's the one point. Michael also talks about the famous line, and we must never forget it's a constitution we are interpreting, and he's absolutely right. Whenever the Supreme Court quotes that, time to brace yourself, because they're about to make up something. What do we think that means? Well, I'm not sure I can exactly speak for John here, although maybe probably. So the first point I think that Marshall had in mind was that the Constitution was a short document, so it wasn't a code. And what that means is that one has to have an acknowledgement of how much meaning and detail can be put into a short document. So one wouldn't expect the same level of detail in a Constitution as one would expect in a much longer document or the kind of constitution some countries have today, which can go on hundreds of pages long. That would be different. But I don't think it suggests, as the Supreme Court has suggested, that we want sort of that it's an invitation to the court to be updating the Constitution. There's a real difference between saying, okay, this is the Constitution won't specify the details. We've got to fairly figure out what the sometimes general provisions mean, between that kind of attitude on the one hand and the opposite attitude of, well, we sort of feel we can do anything we want to under this Constitution, under the idea that it's an invitation to the courts to update. So I don't think that that language means what the Supreme Court thinks it means. Finally, Michael raises this sort of interesting question of you know, what do we do with respect? We need the Constitution to be a workable document, and so sometimes we need to sort of come up with rules to make it work. And he gives the example in McCulloch of Chief Justice Marshall saying that that basically the states can't tax the federal instrumentalities in order to make this work. And I don't know what John McGinnis thinks about this, but I will say I actually think that's one of the situations where even Homer nods and even John Marshall nods in the sense that I think that that was completely unnecessary in the sense that, sure, there needed to be protection of the federal government from the actions of the states, but the federal government had that power. It could simply pass a statute preempting the state actions that would be inconsistent with the federal government, right? So the difference between that rule and the Marshall rule is that it actually requires some action from the Congress, and that power of preemption is much more clearly in the Constitution than the instrumentality immunity that Marshall found. So I think that's a good example of how a justice sort of seeking a result could go beyond the Constitution based on the sort of theory that, well, you know, we need to make it work better, we need to make it work well, when in fact, if you just actually follow the meaning of the Constitution, there would have been a fully adequate result and I think a much more legitimate one. So why don't I stop at that point and we can open it up for questions or unless anyone else wants to say anything.
Well, I just want to add to the point about McCulloch that I think actually the famous line of McCulloch does really underscore our original methods. I think what Marshall is saying is the interpretive methods, which he thinks needs to be applied, there are many kinds of documents. They have to be screened for their relevance to constitutionalism. But I still think it suggests that the interpretive methods are key to constitutional interpretation. And so in some sense, I would not only say Marshall is an originalist, he's an original methods originalist. And on that note, maybe we will take questions.
Very good.
Can I just, Dean, sorry. It just,
yeah, go ahead, Michael. That's Michael Grieve.
Just the three sentences, okay? One is, I want to emphasize, I think the stuff in the book on amendments is terrific, and I wholeheartedly agree, and in some ways that I'm either, you know, there for purposes of now, I would push that even harder. So that there's no disagreement on that at all. The remarks about the maritime law and all the rest of it, that's actually a huge, huge problem, issue and an intriguing question, and it's this. What do you do if the original methods change radically over time? So what those guys had in mind was, and Mike described this very well, right, common law development of a kind that after Erie Railroad we're no longer allowed to have. And so, right, and that's not just maritime jurisdiction, which was hugely important at the time. It's also diversity jurisdiction. And that's half the universe. That's the entire commerce of the United States. And, you know, everyone these days stamps their feet and says, no, you're no longer allowed to think like these people did. And so the original methods in that domain have gone completely by the boards, and now what do we do? It's a huge question. It's a very interesting question. Outside the scope, obviously, of this conversation a little, but I just wanted to have flagged it.
Very good. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We'll get to as many of you as possible. Before we turn to the audience, a quick announcement. Our second annual Executive Branch Review Conference has now been scheduled for May 7th at the Mayflower Hotel here in Washington, D.C. That's obviously a live conference. It'll be about three-quarters of a day, May 7th here in Washington, D.C., if you want to mark that on your calendar. And in terms of upcoming Teleform conference calls, tomorrow at 3 p.m., we're going to be discussing Cypre. That is sort of the unique mechanism by which courts award residual class action settlements to third parties. That's tomorrow at 3. And then on Thursday at 2, we'll host a Teleform with Peter Wallison, talking about the Dodd-Frank Act and whether it's being implemented in the best possible way. But for now, of course, we're talking with Professors Greva, Rappaport, and McGinnis on the new book, Originalism and the Good Constitution, and taking your questions. We've got four questions lined up, so let's go to our first caller.
Thanks for a great discussion. I just wanted to kind of readdress the first principle about here, that even outside the Constitution, all law has to be originalist. The day after it's passed, the world has changed that necessitated the law in the first place. You know, whether it's a day, a year, 200 years, laws become outdated. All you really have to go on is the original meaning. The ability to create, alter, or abolish laws is the mechanism that allows laws to reflect contemporary problems. You know, not judges deciding, well, now it's time for this law to mean something else. And I think what people don't like about this is how long it takes a population to realize that a law needs to be changed. But that was baked right into the cake of political stability and civic peace by the founders. And, you know, I just think, again, this isn't just for the Constitution, although it's supremely for the Constitution, that the original meaning is the basis of all law, because it's the only thing you really have to go on.
Well, let me just say, I think that's, we really very much agree with that. And one of, I hope, the strengths of our book is that our understanding, I think, of why we should follow the original meaning of the Constitution isn't completely different from why we should follow the original meaning of statutes. We generally think that democracy is a good process, a relatively majoritarian process for ordinary legislation. It's relatively good compared to the alternatives, both from its fruits and from sort of a process perspective, and that's why we endorse it. And so I think your point really underscores that our argument that supermajorities are a key process move is very much in keeping with our general process-based arguments in a democracy, that we think there's a way of updating them so long as we have a process that we think, both from a theoretical view of the process, gets pretty good results, and because our experience helps us verify that it's gotten pretty good results at a high level of generality, even if we have disagreements about some particularity.
Yeah, because, you know, it makes me wonder whether on particular issues, you know, say whether it's judicial decisions on gay marriage or abortion, that people who are for the changes in the interpretation of those laws somehow don't realize that the right judges will reverse the exact thing that they want. And once they've pulled the thread out of the tapestry of what the law means, it can quickly be turned right against them. You're really riding the tiger once you start riding the back of the tiger once you start relying on judges and not political argument in order to achieve your end. So it always kind of flummoxed me a little bit that people didn't realize this is going to be turned against you eventually, and it always is.
Michael, why don't you go ahead?
It is never reversed. It never comes back to bite you, at least not in your lifetime.
Okay.
Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, well, it's more of a subtraction, I guess. I don't know. It's just on the side of it. I just wanted to say, it's sort of interesting. Let's look at these two famous cases, Lochner and Roe versus Wade. And let's assume, I'm not so sure, but let's assume for a second that Lochner is not the original meaning of the Constitution, or not anything like it, and that Roe is not. So the questioner's sort of point is a strong one, which is, you know, you can make up something in the Constitution, but you just have to realize that the other side can make up something too. So for years and years in the law schools, the difficult question for sort of advocates of a non-originalist interpretation who tended to be liberal and tended to like Roe and not Lochner was, well, how could you distinguish the two? And they were never able to do so in any way except, oh, you know, Roe is good and Lochner's bad. And if you actually go and you look at the rhetoric involved, it's very little different than that. So it really underscores exactly this point, which is that once you depart, there's very little way of distinguishing good and bad departures except just whether you like it or not.
Let's go to our next caller.
Oh, this is Hadley Arcus. We have three friends whose judgments I respect, even with times when they're at odds. But the book sounds terrific. But I assume that you were defending the Constitution, the modes of governance, that you weren't defending every part of it, you know, like the importation of slaves up to 1808 or the three-fifths rule, which, as Lincoln said, made the vote of white people in Maine half the value of voters in South Carolina. As of course, our friends then would raise the question, wouldn't you be obliged to be aware of the distinction between the underlying principles of the Constitution and those prudential compromises that were built into it? And I assume you were. But I assume also, and I wonder also if you were not just carried in your originalism, must you not be carried back to some of those antecedent principles? You know, I think of the Belmont case recognizing the Soviet Union. And here's Harlan Stone in dissent. And Stone has to be regarded as someone who read the text very carefully. And yet Stone was quite persuaded that nothing in the Constitution precluded New York from trying to protect the assets of Russian nationals from having those assets seized and transferred to Stalin's government. But this is where Justice Sutherland said, when it comes to foreign relations, there is no New York. And, you know, quite apart from things in the text, I think we'd be moved back to something like that axiom in the Federalist 80, where Hamilton says, the peace of the whole cannot be subject to a part, that we can't allow aggressive settlers on the frontier to draw the whole country into a war. In this case, that if New York has it wrong, New York is disrupting a critical decision on the recognition of a foreign government bound up with military strategy. So again, it sounds like a terrific book. I can't wait for the musical version to come out. And do I read you correctly in thinking that you are, in fact, drawn to those principles that may be outside the text but contained in the original principles of the Constitution?
I guess please. It seems to me that that's a sort of complicated question. So I think what at least I would say is that the supermajoritarian process, if it's actually the appropriate supermajoritarian process, incorporates both the principles that people at the time recognized as well as compromises, and that's a good thing, because a good constitution will incorporate both of those things. Now, in the case of slavery that you point out, that's obviously a tremendous blemish both on the original Constitution and on American history. But the point, of course, to see about that is that was excluded, that slaves were not actually part of the supermajoritarian process. And so it's no surprise that the Constitution treated them badly. And that's a serious issue that we address in the book and talk about how basically that feature really did undermine in significant ways the legitimacy of the original Constitution. But of course, that feature, and as well as many others, have been eliminated. when evaluating the Constitution that's gone through the supermajoritarian process, obviously each individual can look at the Constitution and see whether or not they think it conforms to what they think are the underlying principles. But we actually think that the supermajoritarian process itself takes those principles into account, as well as compromises, and of course the fact that different people have different views about those principles, and we all have to live under the same Constitution, and so you're going to want some compromise about those matters as well.
John McGinnis?
There are actually two problems there. One is Hadley's question, which is whether you can make a go of this and draw the distinctions you've just tried to draw, Mike, without some appeal to the principles themselves, as opposed to, are just people's contingent preferences. That's one. And the second thing is there are actually many ways in which supermajorities come about, and your book has interesting things to say about that, and the time will be too short. But one way is genuine agreement on the principles, and the other one is bargains on some compromise position that nobody would defend. And there are two big ones in the Constitution. One is the slavery one, all of which basically has been excised, that's right. The other one is the compromise between large and small states, which the founders themselves, at least one side of the founders, didn't think much of, and which is not terribly easy to defend as a matter of sort of first Republican principles. Madison despaired of it. This is a bit unfair to you guys because the book does discuss this and it's an interesting discussion to have. I just wanted to flag the point that supermajority isn't always the same beneficent supermajority.
Well, if I may just say, there are two points here I think that are important. It is, of course, the case that I think our book actually is the first book in originalism to deal with the problem of excluded groups, particularly African-Americans. If you exclude a group, you're going to get defects from that exclusion. And that is a serious problem for originalism that time doesn't permit us to really discuss here. But we really take that on. But the other point is that, of course, a supermajoritarian process is going to lead to compromises, and that's a good thing because people disagree about what the nature of Republican principles are or what natural law principles are. And so insofar as they make compromises, that's a necessity for getting a consensus, which is essential to fundamental law. And and my concern, I think, perhaps with Hadley's impulse here, is that people aren't going to agree with the list of principles that he or I would most like to see vindicated in a constitution. So I think it's important to say that we actually welcome compromises, that that's going to be an important element of any consensus document. And so if one thinks consensus is crucial to our fundamental law, one can't be against compromise, and one can't really be in favor, I think, of looking to some purified principles as opposed to the compromise that that we have.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dean. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We are up on the hour now. We do have some questions pending. Maybe we can have the three of you back to continue the discussion. My thanks today to Professors Michael Grieva, Michael Rappaport, and John McGinnis. Of course, I should mention that the book is available on Amazon.com, and there's a link to the page to the book in the email notice you got and on our website as well. It's called Originalism and the Good Constitution. I urge you to look it up. To our audience, a reminder to join us for our next Teleforum conference call tomorrow at 3 p.m. when we'll be discussing Cy Prey. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.